And tonight I've got Christopher Bolin, formerly of the American Free Press, to give his side of the story of what happened with him and his job. And I was thinking we'll start off by letting Christopher give a little history of how he got into this job in the first place before we get into what happened to him. So Christopher, are you about ready to tell us how you got into this, how it started? You know, give us a little overview first of all.
Yeah, well, first of all, you know, for the record, I should say I worked for American Free Press since it was founded in 2001. And prior to that, I worked for the Spotlight newspaper for about a year. I started in June of 2000 with the Spotlight. And when that paper ceased to exist and was reorganized, became American Free Press, then I worked for them ever since. But I also want to say that I know you. I've worked with you as a 9/11 investigator since you wrote your book in 2001 or 2002. Well, 2002 when you wrote your book.
It was about the summer of, just before the summer of 2002 that I first remember getting contacted by you.
Yeah, I remember we had email contact and you sent me a copy of your book either online. I think you sent me a hard copy in Berlin and I read it and I was very impressed. And I sent a copy to American Free Press, or you sent a copy to American Free Press, and I remember they read it. I thought Willis read it, and I think he told you to tone it down a little bit, and you actually did. So that American Free Press has been working with you, and I've been working with you since spring, summer of 2002. And I've worked with you as a 9/11 researcher. You know, I've called you, and you have evidence that you've got a great source of photographs and things like that. I've always found you to be a truthful and a logical person, and I don't know that you've ever told any lies, but this I know that you've asked questions on your website about infiltration or control or agents, what have you, inside of American Free Press, which is a newspaper in Washington, and you know, I thought that's you certainly have the right to ask those questions.
Yeah, before we get too much into that, you know, a lot of people don't even know what the Spotlight is and how you got in there and how you got in. You want to, before we get into all of that, could you just run over to the people who have no idea what the Spotlight even is?
Sure. The Spotlight's a weekly, it calls itself a populist newspaper. It started out with the Liberty Lobby. I think the Spotlight newspaper first came out in 1975, I think, about that time. And prior to that, they had a Liberty Letter, and it's part of the Liberty Lobby, but because it was part of the Liberty Lobby, which is a lobby, obviously, in Washington, D.C., it wasn't considered to be a bona fide newspaper. It wasn't considered to be a real newspaper because it had a lobby organization attached to it. So when Spotlight was put out of business. A court ruled against it, and everything was taken from the Spotlight in the summer of 2000. Then they reorganized and created American Free Press, and it's a weekly paper based in Washington D.C. on Capitol Hill. Southeast Washington, D.C. We used to be located right across from the Library of Congress in the old German building, German-American Bund. And when that was taken away and we lost all that, then we moved down on Pennsylvania Avenue a little bit further. And now American Free Press is much smaller than the Spotlight was in its heyday. When the Spotlight used to reach something like 300,000 readers in the United States, today the Spotlight, today American Free Press doesn't reach one-tenth that many people.
Well, what was this Liberty Lobby? What were they lobbying and who were they lobbying for? And what sort of a lobby organization?
Yeah, the Liberty Lobby, Willis Cardo and Elizabeth Cardo were among the founders of that. And they started with other people like Colonel Dahl and people that I don't know that much about their history, but I know they started in the 50s in Washington, D.C., and they started as a newspaper or as a lobby for the American people, so to say, against the special interests. They fashioned themselves as populists, the old populist movement, the small guy, the guy who fights the wars, Willis would say, the guy who fights the wars and pays for them, against the special interests like the big financial interests and what have you.
So it was they were collecting money from just ordinary citizens supposedly to help the ordinary citizens get their way in Congress or something?
But their strong point, I think, has always been their publishing. I mean, that's been their main business. It's been publishing, like I said, the Liberty Letter, and then starting, I think, in 1975 or so, they started publishing Spotlight, a weekly newspaper, and that paper reached at one point something like 300,000 people, and was a pretty successful little independent newspaper.
Well,
it reports things that the mainstream media doesn't touch, and it's kind of.
And you worked there for 1 year as a reporter, just like you were doing with the American Free Press before they actually.
Yes, I started working for Spotlight in June of 2000, and that came about only because I was working for IBM before that. And what happened is that I found Michael Piper's book about the murder of John F. Kennedy, the assassination of John F. Kennedy. I found it to be very interesting. I donated it to my library here in the Chicago area. It became the library said they didn't want the book, although I felt that it was a good historical book. And that became a big First Amendment debate and issue. Then I invited Michael Piper to the library here. He spoke at the library. And in the process of this discussion about the book, I was offered a job at American Free Press. At Spotlight. And so I joined the Spotlight. I left IBM Global Network Services and went to work for the Spotlight. And they wanted me at first to be a congressional liaison. I think that's what I did in the beginning. And then I started writing articles. I was writing articles, every week until the Spotlight went out of business or was closed down by a judge in Washington. In early July 2001.
What's a congressional liaison?
Yeah, well, I was to liaise to, kind of visit Congress office, congressional offices, and lobby. But
you didn't like that?
It was never very well defined. I sort of did lobbied as I saw fit. And of course you can't lobby without any money, Eric. What are you going to go in and impress these guys with your good looks? I mean, you can't lobby with no money. Lobbying is done with money, with clout, with power. I mean, it's K Street. It's lawyers and it's money. It was it was pretty futile. So, That little thing that I was doing basically ceased to exist. And then in November of 2000, I think it was November of 2000, I was made a independent contractor with the newspaper.
And that's when did the reporting.
I no longer got any benefits of any sort. I didn't get any sort of,
Oh, you were insurance. An employee before that.
I was made an independent contractor, which means that you just get paid a lump sum, and you receive no benefits, you pay no taxes.
So before that, though, you were an employee.
Yes, I think for the first 6 months or so, I was an employee.
And then you became
in the sense that they took out salary, payroll taxes, and and I had some form of insurance, but it never seemed to do much.
Okay, so then you became an independent contractor and started writing articles. That's when that happened?
Well, yeah, then I was, well, the thing is that, yes, I was an independent contractor. I believe it was November of 2000. But then, yeah, it was that time. And then, I was writing articles. My basic, job was to, you know, like, represent the paper and to, furnish articles. But, you know, as I learned when I first came to American Free Press, the real essence of working there was the production of the newspapers and the magazine, the Barnes Review. That's what they called the production. That's the product.
And the Barnes Review was back in the days even of the Spotlight?
Beg your pardon?
The Barnes Review, were they publishing that even when the Spotlight was on?
Oh, yeah. Oh, Barnes Review has been around for, yeah, Barnes Review has been around
for. So that has not been closed down then, only the Spotlight.
Right, right.
And then when the Spotlight got closed and you said it reorganized, was it the exact same people or were there some new ones or some?
No, it was the exact same people. It was shut down. I think we didn't put out a paper for about a month. It was about July of 2001. We didn't put out any papers. I was in Chicago. At the time I was, at my house in the Chicago area. You know, I was writing articles and then for about 4 weeks we didn't put out a paper and they reorganized as American Free Press and moved down further down Pennsylvania Avenue Southeast. They said it was an employee-owned paper, but, I mean, they say it's an employee-owned paper, but I've never been invited or I've never been involved in any way in this employee-owned paper.
Well, so when the Spotlight was going down, you were in Chicago. What were they telling you was happening? You were getting...
Well, the thing was is that they didn't tell me a lot, but I understood that there was a judge in Washington D.C. was ruling on a matter that between, I think it was the IHR, their Institute for Historical Revisionism in California. But this was never very clear to me exactly what was going on. It still isn't very clear to me what really was going on. But a judge ruled in Washington D.C. and basically on this bankruptcy case, I think it was, and he seized all of the assets of the Spotlight, including the name. He seized the books, my understanding, the books, the property. The property didn't belong to American Free Press at that time. I think they were renting it or leasing it. They had sold it, and they were renting it, the property. But it was pretty dilapidated, to tell you the truth. The building that we were in at that time, you know, it wasn't very well equipped. It wasn't a very professional office. So
whatever they seized wasn't very good. So then,
they seized the books and they seized the assets and they seized whatever they could, and then we reorganized as an employee-owned paper.
But when they reorganized, while they're going down, you're in Chicago, not even realizing what's going on very well. And then when they reorganized, you're not even part of that either. Then you're not part of the new employee-owned one. What are you?
No, I was not made part of the employee-owned paper. And to be honest, I don't know who the employees are who own the paper. My understanding has always been that Mr. Cardo is the boss. I mean, Willis Cardo is the publisher, and he's the guy that makes decisions. And when, for example, I need to get some money sent to, you know, Venezuela or Germany or wherever I am, I would always have to ask Mr. Cardo. This idea, they say that it's an employee-owned paper. When we talked to Mike Piper about that a few months ago, he told my wife that originally there had been some stocks written up for me, and those stocks had been in his drawer, in his desk, but that they had fallen off the desk or something, and I never got them.
Okay, so now this employee-owned paper is together. You're not a part of it. You're not really an employee. You're still an independent contractor, and now it's right. The American Free Press with one-tenth of the subscription.
In terms of circulation, yeah. Yes. Well, we had a much smaller office. Our offices, you know, were for a while we had an office in Pennsylvania Avenue there that was somewhat okay. It wasn't in a very good part of town.
So the only real difference then from your point of view is that the Spotlight just shrunk and became the American Free Press, or did it seem
even... It shrank in terms of circulation, but it didn't happen automatically. But ever since I've worked for American Free Press, I started, like I said, in 2000, the circulation has been going down. And they always tell me that this is because the readership is old, and our readers are passing away. You know, that our readership tends to be in the World War II generation, in their 60s and 70s and 80s, and these people are dying. But to tell you the truth, there's no, the paper has no competence in promoting itself. I've been told that they're not allowed to grow. That there's like an agreement that they will not grow, that they'll just maintain at a very small. But I mean, the paper, the last time I checked, the readership or the circulation was only like 23,000 or something like that.
Well, are these figures even available to people, the circulation or anything?
No, they're very closely kept secrets. But you know, and that's something. Well, that's something about American Free Press and the Liberty Lobby and everything. They, the way things work, you know, where the money goes and who's reading the paper and how things are going, this is only known to a very, very small group of people. And I'm not one of them. I only get these numbers when I go and I talk to the ladies that do circulation who take care of the database, and I'll ask them sometimes, and they're very, very reluctant to tell me anything, but you know, the last time I checked, it was, like I said, it was in the low 20,000 figure.
Well,
which is a very, very small newspaper.
Well, how did you hear that it's they made an agreement not to grow? Is that something you can explain?
Well, I've been told by the person who brought me into the paper, who's been with the paper for a long time, who's a good friend of Willis Cardo. He told me that, you know, in the 60s, or was it the 70s, because I'm not exactly sure when the spotlight began, but in that time, in you know, quite a few years ago, he had grown the paper to something like over 300,000 readers, and they had 75 people working in the office, you know, opening up the letters and opening up the mail, and a lot of money was being sent in, because it is an operation that does bring in a lot of money. I mean, when I started American Free Press, there were like six ladies sitting there.
You mean your spotlight?
At the spotlight, every day opening up mail, you know, with checks in it.
So in the spotlight, during the spotlight era, there was a lot of money coming in.
Yes.
And yes. You were told at that time by somebody that they were not allowed to grow too big?
Well, yeah, this is what this guy who brought me into American Free Press, his name is Jerry Myers. He's worked with American Free Press, with the spotlight for years. And he told me that it's like that there were death threats and things like that given against Willis Cardo by, you know, CIA or elements like that, that he could not, the paper could not grow. He'd be allowed to keep the paper at a very small flame, you know, in a very small degree, but that the paper could not be a 300,000 reader paper. And this is the thing that this is one of the problems I always had with the spotlight or with the Liberty, with the American Free Press, is every time I came to Washington, even most recently, you know, the American Free Press box in front of the train station, Union Station in Washington, was always empty. And the box on 2nd Street was either not there or empty.
You mean the box that sells the newspapers?
Yeah, you know, in Washington, D.C., they have all these newspaper boxes where people can buy the newspaper. And it used to be, when I first started, you could buy the spotlight at the Pentagon in the morning. You could buy the spotlight on 2nd Street. You could buy the spotlight at Union Station. And the boxes were maintained. But in the last couple of years, I've seen that those boxes aren't maintained at all. Now, did this raise the question? And I always ask these guys, you know, my question to Chris Petrick and Willis Cardo is I don't understand why we can't grow the paper. You know, everything that we've talked about has come to pass. 9/11 happened. We have these awful, disastrous wars in the Middle East. And I just don't, you know, it seems to me that there should, this paper, with a little bit of competence in management paper, we should be selling a million issues each week.
So
I mean, if this paper were properly promoted and pushed, I mean, and run like a real business, I don't see why it doesn't grow. And that's another thing, is that like if it's a business, if it's a newspaper business as a real business, you know, you should tell the employees, well, our circulation this month is 35,000. We're up 5,000 from last month. Let's go for 40,000. You know, all of these kinds of numbers are passed on to the employees so that they have some idea of how the business is doing.
But you never, in all the years you were working there, they never would tell you things like, here's how we're doing, here's our plan for the future. here's never. How many, they would never, it was always a secret. And you heard,
yeah.
Well, if you had heard this before, that they're under some sort of pressure,
yeah.
This would be, it's not me who gave you the idea that something's fishy with this group at all then.
No, and that's what happened on the Michael Piper show when this Scott McCufka fella, Victor Thorne, when he started interrogating me, and, you know, he asked me if I would denounce Eric Hochschmidt and the lies of Eric Hochschmidt, and then he asked me about something that you had written about American Free Press. And it should be understood, he asked me about an article that you had written that I had not seen. You know, his first question was put me off when he asked me to denounce the lies of Eric Hochschmidt. And I said, I'm not going to denounce anybody. But his second question was that about this article that you had written, and I said, I haven't seen it. And not having seen it, I can't give an opinion. I said, I have no opinion. And they held it against me that I didn't, you know,
denounce you. Well, they said you didn't defend the paper, that you were suspicious of them.
Yeah.
But I mean, but
then the thing is that I think that he said that you had said something about infiltration at American Free Press. And, you know, I have to tell you that when I was hired at American Free Press, Jerry Myers is the guy that brought me on to the paper.
You mean hired at the Spotlight?
At the Spotlight. When I was brought on at the Spotlight, the very first day I got there in Washington, D.C., Jerry Myers told me, he says, you look around and you tell me, who do you think is the agent? That's what he told me.
Now, this is just when you get there. You're already hired.
My very first day. My very first day.
So this
so
guy.
I did my looking around, talking to people, sleuthing, and I raised the subject with Willis the other day, because, you know, newspapers are always infiltrated. Editors are usually gatekeepers. I mean, it's taught in college journalism classes. My God, we have a textbook here about communications, a modern communications textbook, and it talks all about gatekeepers and how they operate newspapers and reporting and whatnot.
So it is
this idea that you can have a paper in Washington, D.C. that is criticizing the U.S. government and is critical of what the U.S. government does, and that you are not going to be infiltrated, is absurd. I mean, during the time that I've been at American Free Press, I've seen many people come and go, who I knew were agents.
You knew this?
Oh, yeah. I mean,
you mean coming to go, coming in to visit or influence or something?
Working for the paper. I mean,
working.
A few of them, there was, I don't know, they're thought to be agents, or maybe, I don't follow this too terribly closely, but there was a young Jewish fellow, I think his name was Jack, heavyset guy. He was definitely not on our side. I won't say his last name. Then there was this, of course, the famous Gordon Thomas, the author. He didn't last very long, and he was up there speaking that, you know, basically supporting the CNN view of 9/11 at one of our conferences. And then there have been several, I mean, I don't know about, you know, some of the more recent ones, but I'm not in the Washington office. That's important to understand. I'm very seldom there. I might come to the office in Washington when I was working for American Free Press once or twice a year. There's certainly no way that I should know who makes decisions at American Free Press or what influences prevail there.
But
for me to come out and say, and now you look at American Free Press, they're working very closely with Scott McCufka and Wing TV and Lisa Giuliani. I mean, these people are, in plain English, really pretty sleazy. And I've been trying, since they started attacking me, I've been contacting American Free Press frequently asking, why are we working with these people? Do you know who these people are? I mean, Scott McCufka, Victor Thorne, he's a writer of pornography. Lisa Giuliani is a woman who deserted her family and went and shacked up with McCufka, leaving behind three kids with her former husband. And these people seem to be speaking for American Free Press. I mean, they write for American Free Press. They write for the Barnes Review. And
they published Piper's book also.
Yeah, they published his book in 2005, Dirty Secrets. And they attacked me. They've been attacking me viciously for the last month and a half. And American Free Press has anything to defend me. Basically, it's a campaign of character assassination, I think is what it's called. They're trying to smear me and slander me. And it, you know, what's funny is that it all comes back to this Sam Danner thing.
Well, that's what they're holding up now as more evidence that you and me and...
Well, that's pretty... Eric, I've got to tell you something. That's pretty absurd because I've spoken to him, you know, not as often as you have, but he's called me a few times recently, and he has never... He has always stood by his story with me. He's never reneged it. He's never recanted. He's never changed one bit. But, you know, because when I did write two articles about him, I spoke to him on the radio show, but when I wrote the articles about him, I put in the necessary caveats that a journalist should. I said that if his story is true, then this is what it means. And then I gave, you know, what Sam Banner said. And in the other article, I said basically the same thing. I said, you know, if his testimony is accurate, if correct.
Well, that's all.
That's all we can do.
All we can do is listen to what someone says and then look into it. But
right.
And,
right.
And that's what police do. That's what all reporters do.
Right. Basically, he gave us his testimony, his affidavit of what he saw that day.
And for them to hold that against you.
The readers, and as an eyewitness testimony, and I testimony is never factual. Eyewitness testimony is what a person saw or heard that day or whatever saw, and that it's for the listener or the reader to discern or decide whether it's credible.
Well, yeah, and even if he's lying, it has nothing to do with you. Because think about it. You've also talked to people like the controlled demolition people.
Right.
I mean, those guys very likely lied to you. And, you know, some of the people you've talked to probably have lied to you. And
sure.
What is it supposed to mean to you? It means nothing.
Sure. Sure. Yeah. I mean, yeah, I've written a lot of stories. But when I was dismissed from the paper, this email that I received, basically Chris Petrick, the editor, held two things against me. He said that they cannot be sure that my stories are factual, and because they don't want to check my material, they're not going to pay me to write any more stories. And I wrote back and I said, you know, which story or which thing have I said ever in any of my writings that I've given to American Free Press has not been factual? And he hasn't responded to that. And his second point was that I had been a disloyal employee. Almost like my ancient ancestor Anne Boleyn was a disloyal to Henry VIII and lost her head.
Well, disloyal, you just mentioned that your first day on the job, they're telling you to spot, this one guy is telling you to spot the agent. I mean, you ought to be suspicious, and then you have an employee-owned newspaper, you don't know who the employees are that own it.
Right.
I mean, of course you're going to be suspicious.
Right. And I've always been an outsider, basically, at American Free Press. I've been an outsider, you know, by not being an owner, by not being privy to the inside machinations or decisions. And then lastly, in the last couple years, they've cut my salary twice, each time by 10%, so that I'm being, you know, in the last year, couple years, I was paid less than I was, paid $7,000 less than I was paid when I started. So you see, I really got the short end of the stick. I was also, more recently, I was told to stay away from the conference. You know, 2 weeks after I was beaten up by these thugs on my front yard and tasered, American Free Press had a conference in Washington, D.C., and I was told that Michael Piper had given an ultimatum to the publisher, Cardo, that I shouldn't come.
Well, Piper announced on his show you didn't go because of what, your daughter or son?
No, that's not the reason at all. You know, this is like Mike Piper has a book, Dirty Secrets, and he has another book called Judas Goats, which is interesting. You know, he's got a book, Judas Goats, which just came out, which is all about how the nationalist movement is infiltrated, has been infiltrated. Every aspect of the nationalist movement in the United States has been infiltrated, you know, in Michael Piper's book, Judas Goats, and he points out all these people. So that we shouldn't think that kind of thing is possible at American Free Press, the one populist, the biggest nationalist populist newspaper in the United States, we shouldn't even, you know, consider the thought that they could be infiltrated.
Well,
when I raised this point to Willis Carter the other day, he became livid. You know, but I was saying,
if Piper announces to the world you didn't show up for the conference.
Because of your daughter,
and it really is because he's telling you you're not going to show up.
What he said, if he said that on his radio show last night, I didn't...
Not last night, it was another show.
Whatever he has said about that, that's absolutely false. You know, at first I wasn't going to go to the conference because I couldn't afford it. And then I got a note from American Free Press. They said that they would pay for my train ticket for me and my family to come. And, of course, I was invited as a guest and that I had a hotel room there. You know, I was under the weather for about 10 days with the tasering. The tasering effect really knocked me out. It's a very strong thing. And, of course, I had a fractured elbow, too. But I was ready to come. But then I got these emails about the 26th, the 27th of August, and there was this big email campaign going on around me and through me. And
Michael
Piper,
from who?
Well, Michael Piper tried to create some sort of conflict because I was not happy about the way I'd been treated on the radio show with Makufka. And I said that I felt that I had been set up. I felt that it was a setup. You know, that the way that I was not feeling well, that I was told that we were going to talk about my tasering and the attack. And then he allowed the Scott Makufka to basically change the subject of discussion and, you know, hit me with these four questions about Eric Hushmid. And I felt, well, if we were going to talk about Eric Hushmid's article, well, if you just told me, I could have read the article ahead of time. I would have gone and found it and read it, and then we could have commented on it.
Well, am I the only one who's ever criticized these people? What in the world do they care? That's what I don't quite get. Have they ever been criticized before in all the years you've been working there?
Well, yeah, Eric, they're criticized. They've been criticized, I know, by the ADL, but I guess, and they are criticized by establishment newspapers, and you know, they're basically a spotlight in American Free Press have often been treated badly by the mainstream media. Although we've revealed a lot of important stuff.
But has anybody ever brought up...
Apparently your criticism hit a nerve because, I mean, I hadn't read it, but I know from speaking to you, I know that you are very suspicious of them because of the way they stopped selling your book.
Well, that and other things. It's actually
And that's a very important thing, Eric, because 9/11 is a very real thing. And your book is, in my opinion, the best book on the subject because you provide all of this great photographic evidence. And you ask questions. And, you know, I've lobbied many times to get American Free Press to sell your book and then when they stopped selling it, to start selling it again and to sell your DVD, Painful Deceptions. But I always ran into this strange kind of brick wall. I mean, Willis would say, sure, we'll do it. Never happened. And I couldn't understand that. I just couldn't understand that.
Well, what's happening? Well, what's happening now that they've been collecting money from you? Because I can see here in this September 4th issue of American Free Press, they've got a little coupon people can clip out. It says, you know, to donate money to help Christopher Bolin, you can donate some money.
Okay, that's a good point. And you're bringing that up. That's about my legal defense fund. I heard on the radio show the other night, Mike Piper said something about we did not have to do it. But that's also not quite true because it wasn't my idea. This was Willis Cardo's idea. Willis Cardo, immediately after it happened, said, we'll start a legal defense fund for you. And I said, well, sure, fine, that's okay. And Willis said, you know, we'll set it up. And then, a day or two days after I was beaten up on a Tuesday, I was arrested on a Tuesday, I got out on Wednesday. I wrote my little article about it on Wednesday, and the paper came out, basically went to press on Thursday. And it said there, at the bottom of the article, what you read online, it said, readers who would like to contribute to a legal fund for Christopher Bolin can send assistance to the Christopher Bolin Legal Fund, care of American Free Press, Pennsylvania Avenue, etc. But it says, please make your check or money order out to American Free Press. But, I mean, and so, well, you know, when I went to court, I had to go to court about a month later. I hadn't received anything. And so I called up the newspaper the day or so before I went to court, and I said, you know, has anything been collected from this legal defense fund? Because I said, you know, these Chicago lawyers, they want a lot of money, and I can't retain any lawyer. You know, I don't have any money. And so then they did. I had to go to court the first time, pro se. I went as myself, and I went up there and I told the judge. I said, I'm sorry, but I don't have a lawyer, and I need 30 days extension to try to find a lawyer and to raise funds.
Well, the coupon I'm seeing, it doesn't even say that. I mean, you're making your check, money order, or paying by credit card to the American Free Press. How do you know any? How would you know? I mean, if they won't even tell you their subscriptions, you know, the number of people subscribing, if they won't even tell you who owns the place, this newspaper, right. How can anybody give these people money? Do they tell you anything about money's going?
No, and that's the thing is that I called up and I spoke to the editor, Chris Petrick, and I said, you know, Chris, I need to get a list of the people so that I can, I'm old fashioned, I write letters and we'd like to send everybody a thank you note. Anybody who's contributed, I'd like to send them a thank you note. Personally, because I mean, you know, this is a personal thing. I got beaten up and tasered and I know that I have people who liked my articles and like what I'm doing and I wanted to send a thank you note. I mean, it's the only proper thing to do.
So
they said they couldn't do it. They told me
they want to keep
the accounting
secret.
Department doesn't have time to do that. That the money just kind of came in and they gave me that. They wouldn't tell me.
So they won't give you the names of the people, so you can't thank them.
Well, I spoke to Mr. Cardo on Saturday after I got my letter of dismissal, and I asked him if he knew about this, that I was being fired, and he told me that he basically had read the memo and he agreed with it. And I mean, it's also a little bit absurd because, of course, Chris Petrick isn't the one that makes the decision. It's Willis Cardo. Willis Cardo, you know, Chris Petrick can't fire me without Willis Cardo's approval. And so I asked Mr. Cardo, you know, there's some loose things here. Like I should probably get paid my last paycheck. I mean, I was fired in the middle of the weekend. I would hope that I'd get my paycheck and then my modest expenses from July and August. And that's another thing, Eric. You know, they talk about me like I'm a star reporter for the newspaper. But after I visited you in California and Ellen Mariani and Stephen Jones in Provo, Utah, on my Western sojourn in the spring, I was told by Chris Petrick that I can't travel anymore.
Well, plus the professor at Davis, you talked to him too.
Yeah, bro, Thomas Cahill. I mean, those are very important people. I came back from Europe, and I had my list of people that I had to see, and that was Eric Hushmid, that was Ellen Mariani,
so,
Stephen Jones, Thomas Cahill, and a few others. And I went out to see them, and also because I was reluctant to stay in this area where I live because I knew I was being surveilled by the FBI, so I preferred to be in what I call safe houses. And as I told you when I was out there, you knew that I was afraid to come back here because of what I was going to face.
So they cut. That's when they cut your salary after you had done all those important interviews. And that's when it happened?
Then Chris Petrick, just like that, told me that my traveling, I had prior to that, I had $1,000 a month to use for traveling.
You had what? It just got lost in the cell phone scrambling.
No, can you hear me, Eric?
Yeah, what did you just say?
I had basically been given, Willis Cardo had said that I could spend $1,000 a month or 1,000 euros a month for phones, for faxing, for copying, for doing research, for traveling, for gas, for hotels, for buying newspapers, for all the things that I had to do for my business costs, you know?
Right.
And because my basic salary is very low. And it's been cut several times, like I said. So it's very, very low. And so in order for me to do my stories, I have to have this business allowance. And I was told in June that was, Chris Petrick said, no more.
The entire thing was gone?
It basically said the entire thing. And
this is after you do all those important reports about the air. Professor Cahill, that's where you learn about why they're having health problems.
Well, and
you got Professor Jones.
Yeah, well, the Professor Cahill stuff. I'm glad you're bringing this up. Professor Cahill, you know, when we talked about these nanoparticles that were in the air over Manhattan, coming out of the plume of smoke from October 3rd on until Christmas time, I asked him, well, Professor Cahill, what can produce these nano-sized particles of metals? And he said, only temperatures that are at the boiling point of the metal. That means, Eric, that this molten steel that was underneath the World Trade Center was well above the
melting point.
The boiling point of steel.
Well, that verifies a lot of what Professor Jones was saying with this thermite and stuff. So after you do these really important articles, that's when they decide, oh, no more traveling for this guy.
That's
Instead of saying, this is great, let's boost his salary, boost his... I mean, that's the exact opposite of what you'd expect.
Eric, it's very interesting that you bring that up, because basically that's what's happened ever since 2001 happened. And ever since I started writing about 2001, 9/11, ever since then I've just been basically pushed more to the margin and penalized. I would say penalized. You know, they cut my salary twice.
Well, you said,
And they don't invite me to the conferences. They don't include me in any decisions, and then they take away, like you said, I did all this work out in the Western United States, meeting all these important people. You know, my visit with Professor Jones was very important. And then when I came back, I was told, on my way back, I was told, you stop traveling. So like my wife says, I basically am supposed to like sit at the computer and suck the stories out of a pen. You know, I'm not that kind of person. I need to make phone calls. I need to go to people. I need to meet people. I need to see things. I need to, you know.
Well, what did they send you to Venezuela for then?
Oh, Venezuela.
When was that? I forget. That was the summer?
That was in February of this year. I was in Germany, and I really wanted to go to Iran and Lebanon because I have a lot of – I knew that Lebanon is a very important place. I have a lot of friends there. I spoke at the Axis of Peace. I know the former prime minister and very high-level people in Syria and Lebanon. I wanted to go there. But they instead wanted me to go to Venezuela.
And
they wanted me to go to Venezuela. Basically, they wanted me to go there and to meet the president, Hugo Chavez, and try to get him to help the newspaper with money. They suggested that I should, you know, try to get like $1 million from Hugo Chavez. This is Willis Cardo told me this, and that if I succeeded, you know, that would be good for the newspaper and that I would get a little commission.
So instead of doing some important research work, they tell you to go fundraising with Hugo Chavez.
Yeah, basically.
And did you ever actually get to see Chavez?
Well, no. I planned it that I would invite my friend William Rodriguez to come with, because he's a Puerto Rican guy, speaks Spanish very well, and he agreed to come down. And then he decided to bring along his employer at the time, Jimmy Walter, who I also know. You know.
Yeah.
And I went down there, and Caracas, Venezuela is a pretty chaotic and hectic place. And on top of that, the road from the airport was out of commission, so you had to ride through these shanty towns in the mountains to get to Caracas. But in any case, it was very expensive. I found a place for us to work from, and I waited for my partners to come down. That was William Rodriguez and Jimmy Walter. And then we tried to, arrange to meet the president, but you can't just stroll into a country. As an American, you can't stroll into a country like Venezuela and expect to meet the president.
And then ask him for $1 million?
Yeah, I mean, that's, I told them, I said, I'm willing to give it a try, I said, but what happens if I fail? Then you'll hold it against me. You spend like $2,000 for me to go to Venezuela, and if I don't come back with $1 million,
Something doesn't make sense here. This is more like, here you could be doing something important, and they're having you do this. This is almost like, let's find a way to get rid of him. Put him on something stupid. And if he succeeds, fine. He gets money. If not, at least you wasted his time. I mean, this doesn't sound right. Think about it. If you were in control of a newspaper, would you have sent a reporter over to Hugo Chavez and asked him to raise $1 million like that?
No, I mean, seeing that I was in Germany at the time, you're asking me this hypothetical question. If I was Ezra, I would have sent me to Lebanon. I would have sent me to Lebanon.
And do something important. Do something relevant.
Iran and Syria, because you know at that time last winter, Lebanon and Syria were very hot. Hariri had been murdered. I've written a great deal about the murder of Hariri. You know, I think that would have been the place to go. I mean, that's more my cup of tea. And getting money from the Venezuelans, I think the easier way would be to make a professional appeal to the embassy in Washington. I mean, they're only about 10 blocks away.
Well, you know, the people that are saying, I'm the one making you suspicious of this paper, anybody that looks at what you're saying ought to be suspicious.
Yeah, I know, Eric. Now, this is another thing. Is that I know that you've been suspicious of American Free Press for a long time. And I've always told you that it's the best paper we got you know, it's the best paper we got to try and bring the truth out. And that's the way I've always approached American Free Press. It's a good forum. It's a good venue. It's a, but it's now that it's shrunk so much, and it's I have to say that it's not competently managed. I can't say it's competently managed when they don't even get their newspapers out in the streets of Washington, D.C. You know,
well, unless it's on purpose.
A few blocks down is one of the famous bookstores in Washington called the Trover's Bookshop, right on Pennsylvania Avenue there, Independence Avenue. And our paper, we used to be across the street from the Trover's, and our paper's never been sold there, at least not as long as I've been there. Now, why not? Why don't we take 10 papers over there to Trover's every morning, make sure they have papers to sell? This is the thing, is that it's not promoted.
Well, you're assuming
not promoted.
You're assuming it's incompetence, but it could be, like you said, deliberate, like you implied. You know, they don't want it to grow. Somebody is controlling them. Somebody.
Yeah,
and why do you think, Piper, what is he doing? Do you have any idea what is going on and what the relationship is?
No, but you brought up Michael Piper, and you know, Michael Piper has some, he's not a straight shooter. He is not a straight shooter, I have to say that.
What do you mean?
Well, I mean, he doesn't tell the truth. He's not telling the truth. What he said about me, I got to tell you, Eric, he's the one, after I was beaten up by these cops, they put me on the front page of the paper. They said, American Free Press reporter beaten up by undercover cops. And they wrote my story, and they started collecting money for me. But then but then Michael Piper sent me these really vicious emails on the 26th and the 27th, and basically, the people at American Press told me that you're not allowed to come. You cannot come. We'll send you a little gift.
Oh, to the conference, you mean?
Yeah, I was not allowed to come to the conference. And then at the conference, they told some lies. They said that my son had been in an accident or my daughter had been in an accident. I think Ingrid Grimland or somebody who was at the conference said that my son had been in an accident. Now, that's completely false. My daughter had a broken collarbone, but that didn't prevent us from going anywhere. We were, you know, I was traveling anyway.
So
you know,
I was
told not to come to the conference, and you know, geez, I mean, you know, so much abuse, and so much of this attack on me from my own newspaper. But I didn't quit. I wasn't going to quit the paper. The other day, I came home. My wife said, "You've been fired."
Well, is this the first time you've seen Piper lying?
Oh.
Or don't you know these people well enough?
Now, this is the interesting thing, is that, you know, I was writing about 2000, I was writing about 9/11 from September 11, 2001, basically. I was in New York City that day, and I wrote about it as we ran back to Chicago through Pennsylvania. And now, I was invited to speak in Moscow at a conference in December of 2001. And the same thing happened there. You know, I was trying to get my visa to go to Russia, and I got a very nasty, vicious email from Michael Piper's mailbox. And it was so rude and so offensive. I thought, surely Michael Piper didn't send this. This must have come, somebody must have hacked into his email box and sent me an email with Michael Piper's name on it.
Well, nasty, like what? Saying what to you?
Oh,
not reading it, but I mean, what was the message content?
Just very, very foul language. Very.
You mean
foul
just an offensive. Insult? You mean just an insult?
Yeah, I don't remember. It's very, very foul, offensive language, and just really the worst kind of stuff. You know, I don't talk like that, and that came to me, and I just thought, my God, this must be, you know, some intelligence agency has or some hacker, some Russian hacker has hacked into Michael Piper's mailbox and writing in very fluent English sent me this terrible, nasty letter. And I just couldn't think that Michael Piper would have done that. But then he did the exact same thing this time. And this time.
You mean when? When you got tasered?
Yeah. Well, just like I said, on the 26th, 27th of August, my wife and I received a whole slew of really nasty emails from Mike Piper, in which he was calling me all kinds of foul things, but the main thing he kept calling me was a liar.
And this was because he didn't want you at the conference.
Yes. He told Mr. Cardo, this, I got this from about three people that work at American Free Press, they sent me emails, it was a big thing going on, that Michael Piper had given an ultimatum to Mr. Cardo. Either he goes to the conference, or I go.
So this is
basically,
what...
If I go, he even said he was going to go to Indonesia if I go to the conference.
Oh, Piper said
if I'd come to the conference, he would boycott it. And I thought, my God, what is this? Is this guy's ego that that sensitive? I mean, what is this? You know, so I really don't know. I really can't say that I know Michael Piper. I really can't say that.
So now you're wondering.
And, you know, for American Free Press, you know, they, well, you know, I talked to Mr. Cardo and he said, well, if you write a statement and say that, you know, you vouch for American Free Press and everybody there and everything, and that Chris Petrick, I should negotiate with Chris Petrick, but Chris Petrick won't respond to my emails. I asked him to clarify, where have I lied and where have I said that American Free Press is Zionist controlled? And he won't answer.
You don't know anything about these people, really, though, then, do you? Even Petrick?
Well, that's right. I don't pretend to know anything about them. I've only been to the house of one of them, I think. I don't know these people.
You don't even know Petrick, really?
No, I've never been to his house. I don't know him very well. I can't say that I know him very well. I know he's the editor of the paper. I know that, you know, I know what he was like when he started the paper.
You don't know where he came from or who brought him in?
No, I don't. I don't. I always thought that he was a little bit of a you know, an odd fit there when I first started because he, you know, he was kind of like, dressed in that, a different style. I mean, he had a long ponytail and he had this thing in his tongue, you know, that,
oh, the jewelry?
Yeah, something through his tongue that.
A ring, or rod.
It was a peg that went, that had a little ball on it, was going right through the middle of his tongue. I thought that was very painful. And, he wasn't a Christian. He wasn't part of the Patriot Movement, you know, and my understanding was that he was like into black magic. I mean, somebody told me, or I don't know, somebody said he was a Satanist at that time. And I just thought, my God, you know, and I used to, but I mean, I don't poke into people's, you know, Willis said, you know, you should, you know, as an investigative reporter, you would know what goes on here. Or this. But I said, Willis, I'm not going to investigate everybody at American Free Press. I'm not going to look the gift horse in the mouth.
I know, looking at the other situations, not your own employees.
I saw it, as I told Mr. Carter when I started the paper. I said, I'm willing to join forces with you. You have this paper, I have my positions and my research, and I'd like to join forces with you. And so I worked for them, but I let a lot of things kind of go by, you know, and it's clear, but it's been clear for the last year or so that they've been wanting to get rid of me. And I think it's interesting that that guy from Wing TV, Scott McCoofka, even seems to have known that. He said something on last Friday or so that they've been trying to distance themselves from me for a while.
Well, what reason would this be? Because you've never done anything to them, have you? I mean, the only thing that could be is that you've been looking into the Israeli connection. What else have you done that could possibly have...
Yeah, that's what I've always said. You know very well that my position on in 9/11 research has become very focused on the Israeli involvement, and I'm, you know, like when we were on the European tour, I was the only one that talked about that, and at one point they wouldn't even let me speak in Vienna because they thought I was too sensitive. But I always said that, you know, if anything happens to me, it'll probably be because what I've been writing about the Israeli involvement in 9/11.
Well, what about, you know, one of Piper's friends apparently is David Duke. I mean, what do you see? This is what, to me, when you look at all of this, it looks like this is like a big network. He is really defending him, because that's one of the things he doesn't like me and Daryl Smith talking about, is David Duke seems suspicious. Mm-hmm. Do you see any connection between David Duke and American Free Press at all?
Well, there's a connection. There's definitely a connection. I went through Louisiana, New Orleans, about a year and a half, 2 years ago, and David Duke invited me to be on his radio show. And I was on his radio show for a couple times, and he told me we were going to talk about 9/11, but when we got on to the radio, he didn't go there. He didn't want to talk about 9/11 too much, and he didn't seem very interested in 9/11. But, you know, I thought maybe that's just the way he is. But I know that you know, Mr. Cardo and Mike Piper are close with are pretty close to him.
Both of them are? Cardo also?
Yeah, Mr. Cardo goes down and speaks at his conference in spoke at his conference in New Orleans a couple months ago.
Oh, so they're all friends. It's not just Piper.
Yeah, they don't write about it though. That's interesting. They don't write about it. But I know that Mr. Cardo just about 2 months ago or so went down to New Orleans and spoke at a conference that David Duke was having in New Orleans.
Well, then that could explain why Piper is so defensive also of Duke. And then I guess you don't know about any of the others at all, really, do you? Well, what are you going to be doing now? Do you have
what
any
others?
Like the other employees there or the people that they're defending, Wing TV, Mark Glenn, Mark Farrell.
No, I don't know.
Mark
I don't know
Lane.
About, I don't know about them. I don't know about Mark Lane or Glenn, but I do know that a little bit about Makufka and Giuliani. And it's interesting that when I saw that Lisa Giuliani was attacking me so much, I just checked her out on the Internet, and I saw that her name was spelled Giuliani. And I said, that's not an Italian name. And I checked into it, and it's actually misspelled. But I went to the library the other night, about a week ago. In a half an hour, I found an article from 1995 about her and her husband, about how they had lived down in Florida and Ormond Beach, Daytona area, and had gone back to Minnesota and were visiting with, had stayed with his family in Woodbury. So I just went to the telephone book and checked out for the Giulianis, the misspelled Giuliani, in that part of Minnesota, and called them up. And I spoke to her in-laws. And her Marie Giuliani was very nice, and so was Eugene, her in-laws, former in-laws. And they told me that she'd walked out on her family, and I, contrary to what Scott Makufa says, I didn't say anything dishonest at all. I said, I'm a journalist, American Free Press, and I'm being attacked by this Lisa Giuliani, and I'm just trying to find out why she's doing this. And they told me that she had three children, and shortly after 9/11, she had left her husband with the three boys. Only one of them is actually his. The youngest one was 8. And she said she was going to go visit some friends, I think they said in Wisconsin, and she never came back. And then they called up these friends in Wisconsin, and finally they found out that she had gone to Pennsylvania and was living with Scott Makufka. So, I mean, you know, so when I found that out, I wrote, you know, this woman was attacking me viciously. She's attacking me viciously on the Internet. And I wrote a little note, and I said that you should go back to your family. Go back to your kids. You know, do the right thing. And, you know, stop attacking me and stop attacking honest 9/11 truth people like Eric Hufschmidt.
And that's when you got fired shortly after this, I guess, wasn't it?
Yeah, that seems to be, you know, because
maybe the final straw.
Scott Makufka wrote me letters, emails, and he wanted me to be on his radio show or something, but he said that he's also sent these to my bosses at American Free Press. And the next day I was fired.
So maybe, unless it was a final straw. So now, do you have any plans yet, or do you think you can try, because you could try making it on your own now. We could just, get going, and we could all, hopefully, all
I'm going. I'm going to start my website
because we can hopefully get people to. We might be able to get you going here on your own independently.
And I think that this country deserves to have a really good newspaper. But I don't know. You know, it seems like it's so much work to make a newspaper, and it's difficult. But I think that, you know, in this day and age, a real solid patriotic newspaper should exist, and it should be transparent. I mean, I really think that, you know, any newspaper that calls itself populist and patriotic, you know, should be a above board operation. You should be able to see who owns the paper and where the money goes and how many people buy the paper, what have you. It should be a real thing.
Well, you can also do it. We can do it electronically now. You can still,
right.
There are people doing this with subscriptions or just
right.
donations. So we can keep it going, because you're still looking into the Israeli connection anyway, aren't you?
Yeah.
Right now.
Yeah. Well, yeah, we should do that.
Because if we get enough support from our own listeners, that, you know, we might be able to get this. We got to find out if we can keep it going. Because people have to realize there is something fishy about all these publications. American Free Press is just one of them. They're all...
Well, the thing is that there's really something fishy about 9/11, for sure. And you know...
all these groups, there's not much of an alternative out there if you want to get the truth about any of this. You know, there's no real alternative for people.
Well, that's it, Eric. You know, the media in this country is very, very tightly controlled. And it's the only thing that we have going for us, for the truth, is really the Internet now. And yet the Internet is just swamped with disinformation. So one really has to be, you know, careful. And, you know, because... Like these people, Lisa Giuliani and Scott Makufka, are saying terrible things about me, and a lot of other people are also attacking me. I'm being attacked by the ADL last week, 2 weeks ago. I'm being attacked by the Haaretz newspaper in Israel. They really opened their guns on me. And I have to say, why am I being attacked so much? Why? What have I done? And it seems like it's open hunting season on Christopher Bolin.
Well, yeah, and if you look at what some of the other people are saying, it's not. Look at David Duke. He criticizes Israel. Mark Glenn criticizes Israel. Mark Farrell. How come they don't get the attacks like yeah. this? I mean, how come the attacks are so focused on you, me, Daryl? You know, there's like only a few of us that really get it. And it's almost, to me, this is all evidence. There's something fishy going on here.
Yeah, well, they also attack Stephen Jones.
Well, they're surrounding him, too. They're surrounding yeah. him with these scholars for 9/11 truth.
Yeah.
And that could be what the whole point of the scholars is. Surround them and then fill in most of what the website is with other stuff.
Yeah, well, Stephen Jones is a solid guy, and when he found out that I'd been fired, he sent me an email the same day, and he was I think the first person to write to me. You know, Stephen Jones, what he's done with the 9/11, the molten metal is key because he has proven scientifically that thermite was involved, that this was not a normal fire,
right,
and that these buildings were brought down. And if anybody in this country, you know, cares about the truth, they should look at Stephen Jones' paper and draw their own conclusions.
Well, what we can do now is just try to get the listeners to this show to help support you, and we can
Great.
Keep your research going. That's what we got to find out now, if we can get the support and, you know, draw the people away from all the newspapers, magazines, television shows, and bring them over here. And
we have to give them, Eric, we have to give them a better product. That's all. You
that's
know,
right.
I like American Free Press. I thought it was a good newspaper. I just think that I was, it's not the American Free Press that I thought I knew. I think that's really what I've learned. And I think that, we can do better, Eric, and we should do better.
Well, let's give it a try. We'll see what we can do.
Thank
get the,
you.
Get the listeners, and we'll talk to you soon.
Thank you very much, Eric. Good night.
All right. Good night.
Bye-bye.